Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Smathers and Branson. They are back, they've been supporting the pod. These products are phenomenal. They sent me a little care package. I had already had some Smathers belts, but a big revelation is their hats. They're incredible. They have a performance hat. They have a regular hat, like your regular cotton hat. I love this thing. They sent me the Dancing Bear, the Grateful Dead logo, the iconic Dancing Bear hat. It's like my new favorite hat. I wear it all the time. People are always asking me, Deadhead are asking me what my favorite album is, and then, other people are like, where's that from? They think it's from like a course. It would be a sick course logo. But anyways, Smathers Branson, they got all kinds of gear on their website. They have over 115 colleges and universities, MLB, NFL, NHL. They've got other bands. They've got Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer gear, belts, wallets, luggage tags. They have all kinds of needlepoint goods. They're really classy, durable. Like, the belts that I've had for a couple years are still in great shape. You can get 15% off your entire order plus free shipping if you use the code fried egg. That's just one word, fried egg. This is great Father's Day gifts, So if your wife's scrambling to look for something, or you are scrambling to look for your partner, your husband for something, get them some Smathers gear at smathersandbranson.com. That's smathersandbranson.com, fried egg. Today's episode is a good one, I think. That's my opinion, though. You can tell us if you like it or not. But we have the great Michael Clayton, former European tour player, golf course architect, golf course critic, golf course analyst, golf writer. I mean, this guy is a jack of all trades, one of the best golf minds that we have in the world. Michael has not been on the pod in quite some time. I think he was one of my first 15 episodes, and he hasn't been back on, which is regrettable. I mean, I should have him on much more often than I do, and we're going to remedy that today. He joined me late last week. We talked a little bit about the U.S. Women's Open, a lot of preview stuff, but not a lot of preview, a little bit of preview stuff, but we're going to keep that in. And with the U.S. Women's Open, we were having Garrett Morrison, our managing editor, and Will Knights come on after Michael, and we'll break down that as well as some other thing, prescient things in golf. So stick around after Clates, who we talk about, the U.S. Women's Open, Phil Mickelson's win at Kiawah, and then, some world tour ideas and also his upcoming work at Seven Mile Beach in Tasmania. So without further ado, here's Mike Clayton, and stick around for Garrett and Will later in the episode.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
So we haven't talked on this podcast at all about Phil winning. I've been traveling like crazy. Did you watch much of the PGA?
I didn't. I watched the last 12 holes.
What'd you think of Kiawah, the little you saw it?
Again, I thought the mowing lines were, why are all the bunkers in the rough? make it all short grass. The scores were pretty high. It was a USGA type scoring deal. So,
the scores were high because the elements. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have played any easier. And I wrote something up about some notes about the setup. Like, they had rough where it would stop balls from going into the water. Like the bailouts left it because this rough just stops it. And it's just silly. Then you have bunkers in the rough. I don't think the course would have played significantly easier if it was wider.
And the original concept was wall to wall short grass, right? Mm-hmm. I assume.
Yeah.
So how was it? I don't remember, but it wasn't set up that way for the Ryder Cup in 91, I assume. No. And that was, that was brutally difficult. So I remember that playing that last, watching that last day in 91 where maybe Faldo hit that 14th green, maybe that par three. It was just group after group couldn't hit it on that green. It was such a difficult shot. So it's not like it needed rough to make it difficult. But, I thought what Mickelson did was amazing. He's clearly worked hard, lost a lot of weight. He's doing lots of speed training to keep his club at speed up with the younger guys. I suspect, I'm not sure if this is right, but I suspect that the modern equipment has kept the older guys in the game more than it used to. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's right. I mean, Julius Boros was a great player at 48. Sam Snead, people forget that Sam Snead was, I think, fourth, ninth, and third in his 60th, 61st, and 62nd year in the USPGA. Mm-hmm. So the equipment wasn't keeping Sam Snead in it. Sam Snead was keeping himself in it by just being an amazing player. And, Peter Thompson, if he was here, the first thing he would say was, see, I told you long swings last longer. Mm-hmm. He loved the way Snead played, and he would love Mickelson's big long backswing because – his take of observing golf for the longest time was that long swings lasted longer. And he would point to Mickelson at 50 saying, see, I told you. And it's such a cool thing for a sport to be able to do. And Watson was nearly almost 10 years older when he did it. I mean, imagine Novak Djokovic or Nadal winning French Opens in their 50, when they're 50.
Yeah.
Mind you, the way Nadal goes on clay, he still might, but... it's an incredible thing about the game that people can still be competitive at that age. And for me, that was almost the biggest take out of Phil winning was that it showed what a cool game it is.
Yeah, it was amazing too. The crowd, it showed kind of Phil's gravitas because he's playing with Brooks Koepka, who's won four majors in the last like 4 years. And, there were very few Brooks fans in the crowd. Yeah, I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I don't know him. I've met him once. I don't know him at all. And I just really like the way he plays. I really like the way he is. It seems like he turns a lot of people off, but I just kind of think he's from the outside, and it's always impossible to tell from the outside what someone's really like, but I've always liked the way he played. I've always liked his attitude. I just think he's a cool guy. I like the fact he went to Europe and played on the Challenge Tour and worked his way up through there. I just think he's taken a different path to where he's got to, and I think he's an amazing player. But you're right, he was a bit part. Must have been so frustrated. And Phil played him like it. I mean, the best take I heard on what happened that day was your pod with Brennan about just walking around and observing the crowd. Mickelson on 11 where he kind of didn't hear Brooks screaming at him about, I'll play. And, that was a great take on what happened that day.
The experience really showed off, especially in that back nine. Like, he was patient. It was, I think everybody that's played competitive golf has been there where, Brooks was just having one of those days where things weren't going right, but he never was that out of it until early in that back nine. And he just kind of shot himself in the foot with some, he missed a short putt. He hit it in the schmutz on 13. But Phil, yeah. Phil didn't really do anything except just not make a big mistake.
Yeah. And, it was interesting talking about this Naomi Osaka. I mean, this is a long bow to draw, the Naomi Osaka fiasco this week. Mm-hmm. But, the pod I listened to that you did, you could only explain what really happened by seeing what Koepka's ball was doing in the air. I think it was the 11th hole, that par five, where it blew it up in the air and
10,
it felt good.
10.
If you're sitting in the press tent, you can't see that. You can't see what that ball does. You've got to be on the side, and you've actually got to see what the ball does. So the Osaka thing about not talking to the press, this is a bad analogy perhaps, but if you can sit down and watch a tennis match and then go and report on what happened, you don't need a quote from a player.
No.
I mean, just go watch what happened and tell us what happened. So your pod, when I listened to it, it's like that explained perfectly. Okay, now I know what happened because there was someone out there who saw what Brooks's ball did. If you sat in the press tent, you couldn't see that.
Yeah, I mean, it was clear. Like, because the thing that was interesting about that was, like, he had that ball, and it was in the short rough, which you would think would be, you know, that's keeping the spin off the ball. Like, I kind of sometimes really like when the ball's in the short rough when I'm heading into the wind, because I know, hey, it's gonna flight pretty easy.
Yeah.
You know, and the way it got eaten up, and then Phil hit, you know, that punch seven. It was just, that was such a beautiful shot that he hit.
Yeah.
You know, and he drew it, and then he talked about it on Live From after, about how he, you know, if I hit the punch seven, or if I drew the seven, I knew the wind was going to take, I think he said 12 off. If I faded it, I knew it was going to take 30 off. And Brooks hits that little fade. And that's exactly what happened to Brooks's, was it took 30 off. I rewatched the telecast just to, you know, see what was going on. And I was surprised that the ball didn't plug. And I thought it might plug when I was watching it, the way it floated in. I mean, it looked like it hit brick wall. Following that, his distance control was off almost every approach shot. He was long, then he was short. And, you know, when the elements, I think this is why we see the Open the way it is, where older guys compete in the Open, why Watson almost won one, is when elements are the big driver, when elements are the key difficulty of a golf course, all of a sudden then experience matters a ton, and being able to hit a lot of shots. I'd be interested to see with, I feel like, you know, a lot of the guys that get to the very top have a lot of interests or played a lot of sports other than golf growing up.
I think that's probably true. You know, I know that the head of the Sports Institute in Melbourne, which started the golf program, the first two players out of that were Appleby and Allenby. They were always big on kids playing other sports. I mean, Brad Hughes was a really good footballer. Bob Shearer too. You know, I think good athletes are good athletes, and they're always going to be good at other sports. Mm-hmm. Not always, but I think it's a mistake to focus, you know, as a 6 or 7 or 8 year old, and you can bet there are plenty of them out there now focusing solely on golf. It can't be a great thing. You know, but they either get burned out because they're fed up with it by the time they're 16, or they miss out on the fun of playing team sports and playing other sports. And it doesn't kind of develop that innate athletic skill. But I guess, you know, how much other sport did Tiger play?
That's a good point. That's what I was just thinking about. And I don't think he played much of anything. So, you know, the greatest golfer of all time is the foil. But you look at, like, Rory, obviously, famously played soccer forever. You know, he broke his ankle in the middle of one of the best major runs. You got Brooks up there that's played a ton of other sports, baseball being one of them. But, you know, one of the most amazing things I think about Phil is that he hasn't lost his nerve on the greens.
Yeah. Is that, is that just a cliche thing in golf that, you know, started off back with Gene Sarazen, where, you know, the older you get, the more you lose your nerve on the greens. I'm like, is that – when you look at those old tapes of guys playing in the – up until – I mean, Palmer had the classic kind of flippy-wristed stroke. All those guys had kind of strokes that were bound to get yippy as they got older. Yet Bob Charles was the one guy from that era who had the shoulder kind of triangle thing all working together. I mean, Charlie never got the yips. He was an amazing part of his whole career. Mm-hmm. And he was the best, you know, putter I ever saw. So I wonder if that goes back to guys saying, well, you know, you lose your nerve on the greens as you get older, because that was a product of guys with flippy wrists and strokes losing their nerve as they got older. Whereas, you know, technically, I mean, Mickelson's got a stroke that's a lot like Bob Charles's stroke. So, you know, as you get older, if you've got more of that free-flowing kind of altogether, much less wristy stroke. Ben Crenshaw again, you know, is that what saves you? Mm-hmm. As opposed to that Palmer type, you know, that really flippy-wristed, you know, stroke that he had, where, you know, Palmer would complain about, you know, losing his nerve in his 40s. But, I mean, Jack never lost his nerve.
When did the technique change from the flippy stroke to the predominant, you know, what we see today?
Probably in the 70s, I guess.
And was it because the greens got better and it became, was that flippy stroke because of the slow greens?
It probably was. If you've gone, I played the Taiwan Open a few times when I was a kid, on the worst greens you've ever imagined. I mean, they're horrific greens, worse than putting on fairways. And all those guys had that flippy stroke. It looked like they were doing it almost to flip the ball up above the grass and get it top spinning. So, you know, that probably had something to do with it. But I suspect the influence of Charles and Crenshaw had quite a bit to do with it, the way they stroked the ball and putted. But you're right, as greens got better, then that flippy wristed stroke disappeared. But the greens were always great in Australia. Mm-hmm. And Kel Nagel was our best putter. Kel was he was more of a Gary Player type pop stroke. He would break his wrist as he took it back and pop it into the ground and sort of jab the putter. And he was an amazing putter his whole career. But, I suspect in Australia, I had guys who worked for Claude Crockford in the 60s at Royal Melbourne. And they said the greens were pure then. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Thompson was a wristy kind of putter. You know, I think perhaps it was a product of, you know, younger Thompson probably watched, you know, well, I'm not sure he watched anyone play, but, you know, Bobby Jones was a dominant player of the era he grew up in. And he loved how Snead played, and Snead was a kind of flippy-wristed putter. Hogan, same. So perhaps that was just the way they did it because they just copied each other. I'm not sure. And I think without mentioning names, there's probably a pretty direct correlation between alcohol and the yips as well as you get older.
Going, taking a run at my boy.
Yeah.
Where do you put Phil? I think it's a bit trivial to go back to, like, you know, Bobby Jones. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just impossible to compare across 100 years. You know, it's just kind of silly. Let's just say, like, you know, from kind of the Palmer player Nicklaus era on, where does Phil fall in your kind of tiers of players? I think you could put Jack and Tiger kind of in their own stratosphere. Where does everybody else fall in there?
Well, I guess, you know, six and seven majors seems, well, you, I mean, player with what did player of nine, mm-hmm. then, you know, Watson, Palmer, Trevino, Phil, Faldo, Seve, Ernie kind of just perhaps hanging on to that group. You know, but those guys, so six, seven, eight, nine majors are all around the same mark, you would think. But because they're such, you know, to judge someone purely by number is such a fickle thing.
Yes.
Because, you know, we know that what a fine line there is between, you know, Scott Hoke makes that putt on the 10th green at Augusta and Faldo's back with Seve. You know, is Scott Hoke missing a 2-foot putt the defining thing between Faldo's career and Seve's career? Shouldn't be, you know. So, you know, if you lumped Phil, Palmer, Seve, Faldo, Trevino all in the same group, it's pretty hard to split them. I think Palmer gets more points for, you know, making golf cool in America. Seve gets more points for opening up golf in Europe. Phil gets points for how the fans have continued to love him forever. You know, Trevino, in his own unique way, contributed a massive amount to the game. Player, because he played all around the world. Watson, because of what he did at the Open. So they've all done amazing things for the game just outside of the number of majors they won.
That's the thing, too. Like, Trevino's, like, backstory and how he got there, like, you know, and then the fact the guy got struck by lightning twice. He still won six majors.
Yeah, no, an incredible player. And I think Ernie gets hard done by in the second best player of the Tiger generation argument because he had such an incredible record outside of the PGA Tour in America. I mean, Ernie won at Royal Melbourne. He won at Muirfield. He won at Wentworth. He won in South Africa. I mean, Ernie won all over the world. And Phil, for, you know, for the longest time, Phil had a pretty miserable record outside the United States. And he almost his defining major was the one at Muirfield.
Yeah.
Even more so than this one, where he proved he could. I mean, his record in the Open was atrocious, given how good a player he was for the longest time. But what he did at Muirfield, and as well as he played that day, I mean, that was amazing golf he played that day. So that, you know, that to me was almost the almost more defining major of his career than this one.
His whole career is such a crazy case. Just all the struggles till he won one. You know, he has I mean, the first Masters is a defining. He has, in a way, he's got like three defining moments now where he's got the Masters, the Muirfield win, and then this one is like an emphatic exclamation mark on the career. And, you know, who knows if he'll, I'm sure he'll contend in something. You know, if you asked me 9 months ago, I might say he was completely toast because but you know, I'm sure he'll contend in an Open or maybe a Masters down the line here if he, you know, given how well he played.
Yeah, and you know, when did he win that thing? When he was an amateur, 1991. Yeah. So, you know, 30 years is that's an amazingly long career, incredible career. But going back to what we were talking about before, and it's always struck me as amazing that between, you think of all the great shots Sam Snead, Arnold Palmer, and Phil Mickelson have hit in the US Open, all of them, you know, you can put a highlight reel together that would last for a day. And they've got one between them. I mean, how can that be right? And to me, that goes back to the
setup.
I mean, it goes back to the setup. How can those three incredible players have 1 year or so in between them? It just doesn't seem right. You know, if I was a USGA, I'd be looking saying, what are we doing to screw this up so badly that those three incredible players won 1 year or so in between them? And then they're going to say, well, Jones won four and Hogan won four and Jack won four and Willie Anderson won four. So take that. And, you know, good argument. But Snead never won a US Open. Mickelson never won a US Open for all the great golf they played there. And partly it was luck and partly it was, you know, but partly it was perhaps the fairways were too narrow.
Yeah. I mean, is it because it becomes not about skill when the fairways get so narrow, you know?
But Curtis Strange is going to say, and it's a legitimate point, you've got to hit the ball straight. You've got to drive the ball in the fairway.
Not anymore.
Well, that's I'm going to be the last guy to disagree with that. And clearly that's the way it's going. So, you know, I go back, you know, I keep putting that thing up on Twitter about that round in 1969 where Arnold Palmer at Champions, his average iron into a green was a 4-iron.
Yeah.
And if you give, you know, if you average a drive out at 300 yards and you average a 5-iron out at 190 yards and do the maths, it's 8,300 yards to create the same test. And if the course is 8,300 yards long, you can have the fairways 50 yards wide. And it's still going to be a tough test.
I wish I had in front of me. In the Oakland Hills book, they've got all the irons that Hogan hit into the in the 50 Open, and it's like, I think he hit 7 or 8 three irons or more.
Well, I mean, probably certainly one of the best par fives in America is the 16th at Shinnecock, which is an amazing second shot par five. But I mean, the art of building a great par five is building a tee shot that's kind of just build a tee shot. Mm-hmm. And then build a great short par four from there.
Well, that's the thing. It's like what you were saying is what I started thinking when you said build a great short par four. Unfortunately, what's happened is after the tee shot, it's a long par three now.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I don't know. So obviously, you know, this Saudi Arabia thing, the PGL has been kind of hanging over the, you know, seems like, to a certain extent, it's died down. It's back to the drawing board. But one of the things that I have heard, you know, just rumblings, nothing confirmed or anything about, is the idea of a higher level tour and more, you know, where, you know, the best players are playing more often, say 20 times a year, potentially across the world more than the, you know, PGA Tour now. Like, you know, what are your thoughts behind, obviously, the idea of a world tour? I think it's obviously been long rumored. You've been, you know, one of your countrymen's been long a champion of this. And I'm curious what, you know, if you could give us the history maybe of the idea of a world tour and what your general thoughts are.
Wow, lots of things. Well, the European Tour is a world tour, really.
Yeah.
Outside of the United States. I think if in 1980, you could have sat Faldo, Nick Price, Norman, Seve, Langer, Lyle, all those great non-American players in a room and said, okay, we've got a chance to make an amazing tour outside of America where if we stick together, we go to a promoter or promoters and we create something outside of the United States where we can all play, we can create what in 40 years' time is going to be the greatest tour in the world. They could have done that. It would have been like Formula One car racing versus NASCAR, I guess. I'm not that familiar with car racing in America, but, you know, the great big circus that goes around the world that is Formula One, they could have created that same thing. To the point where every great non-American player, that's where they'd be playing now. But that never happened. So, you know, the PGA Tour became even, you know, it's even bigger now than it was then.
Well, so, I think part of that, you know, too, is, you know, the dominant players shifted where, you know, at that time in the 80s, the best players in the world were worldwide players. And now the pendulum's kind of swung to where the best players of the world are American.
Yeah, probably. Well, Rory's not American. Yeah, there are lots of great non-American players.
I was walking with a sibling of a player who's just said, well, Rory's pretty much an American now.
The first proponent of a world tour was Peter Thomson. But unlike Greg, he actually, well, which is not fair on Greg, you know, because Greg played a lot around the world. But Thomson actually went and started the Japanese tour and the Asian tour by going and playing a lot of his golf there when he was the biggest non-American player in the world. So this will kind of amaze some listeners, but Peter Thomson one year passed up an invitation to play at Augusta to play in the Indian Open in Calcutta. That was how committed Thomson was to playing. And it's also a commentary on perhaps the Masters in the mid-60s wasn't as big as it is now. But, you know, Thomson was a go, got off his ass and went and played in Japan and played in Asia. He basically started the Asian tour because he realized that golf was a bigger game than the 60-plus jobs it offered players in America. So it was up to him and Locke and the best overseas players to create something outside of the US. So he was a huge player in Britain, on the continent and around the world. So that was really, and he was always a big supporter of, let's create a world tour. Mm-hmm. But it never really happened because America always had the money and it always had the best players. And, you know, it was just always what it was. It was always bigger than everything else. And when Tiger came along and the money exploded, then inevitably you had all of the best players. All the best Australians, all the best Europeans went to America to play because that was where the money was.
Yeah, because right at the beginning of Tiger, the European Tour was still a pretty good force, and you could argue maybe had better players at the top. You know, they had Westwood, Montgomery, Nick Price. You know, at the beginning, end of the 90s, you know, and then you had Sergio come on the scene at the end of the 90s. You know, but that was, you know, the 2000s is where it just completely shifted.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I mean, Nick Price hadn't been in Europe since 1983. Yeah. But, you know, people forget or probably never knew that in 1990, the prize money on the Japanese tour was almost the same as the American tour because the yen was so strong. It was amazing how much money they were playing for in Japan in 1990. It was a huge tour. You know, then the economy kind of collapsed and the prize money hasn't really moved since then. But you're right, you know, Tiger's influence was incredible. The money exploded. All those guys realized that if they could play well on the PGA Tour, they could make so much money than they could outside of the US. But, you know, golf's a better game when it's more diverse. When you see, watching Tiger play the President's Cup at Royal Melbourne was just incredible to watch that guy play that golf course. The course is not long, but you know, it's the greens are rock hard. It was windy. It was summer. To watch Tiger play that golf course was just a masterclass in genius golf. And the more the game can show off that multi-dimensional weather, you know, and the only way to do that is to go around the world and play. Can't the PGA Tour can't do it because it's so one-dimensional in what you see every week. Going back to the long grass around the greens, and it's not this, but you know, narrow fairways, high grass, not so much wind. I mean, you know, they're all generalizations, but, you know, it gets very one-dimensional compared with what you could show off around the world.
Well, I think it's not a coincidence that Royal Melbourne played so un-American and it was the best chance the internationals have had to win in a President's Cup in a long time. Like, would golf be overall... professional golf and interest in professional golf be in a better space if say you know the tour eventually gets to a place where the top players play every, you know, maybe say 20 times a year, and then there's a feeder tour that feeds into the premier tour, and but then, you know, the counter thing is that there'd be more time for other events in terms of whether it be women, more airtime for women's events, more airtime for college golf, more airtime for amateur golf. Do you think the game would end up being better than having, you know, 50 weeks a year of PGA Tour golf?
Yeah, the PGA Tour plays too much golf, doesn't it? Seems to me it does. Yeah, it's not that the Australian Tour really matters. It matters if you're Australian, but Europe extending outside of April and the end of September, which is when it was played in 1980. Now, the Europeans figured, well, they worked out they could play in South Africa, they could go to the Middle East, they could play in Australia. So Australia was great when Nicklaus and Palmer and Player would come down in November in the 60s and early 70s, and then Faldo and Seve and Langer would come down in January and February. Sam Torrance, all those guys would come down in the 80s and 90s because there was no play in Europe. So you're figuring out that it could go for 12 months and the PGA Tour going for 12 months kind of killed off interesting tours around the world, which is a small thing, but it still matters, I think. But you know, the PGA Tour playing forever, you know, 50 weeks a year doesn't do golf any good at all, nor does it do the PGA Tour any good at all. Mm-mm. But the reality is that the PGA, all PGAs, the players' unions. And the job of the players' union is to give their members as many playing opportunities as they can. And the great disruptor of that would be the PGL, which would steal away the best. And as much as I hate the idea of stealing away the best players and having them for yourself, it just steals away the best players from the union. So it completely weakens the union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which in the end, it can't be a good thing. Well, so rather than blow the PGA Tour up, perhaps cut it back to, you know, 35 events and let the rest of the world have it for 15 weeks a year.
Or have it be, you know, the best players, there's 20 spots that you got to qualify, and making it more global. I think, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the European Tour and the PGA Tour with this alliance, you know, that they have now.
Yeah.
But like, maybe all of a sudden the Scottish and the Irish Opens are more attended by PGA Tour players, you know? Maybe, and I don't know how they do it. Maybe it's all important FedEx Cup points or whatever the hell what that means. But the, you know, if I think that scarcity, it's really, you know, the most popular sport in America is football, and it's not even close. You know what the scarcest sport in America is? the least amount of games? Football.
Football, I assume. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And I think it's almost directly correlated, like the sport's popularity to the amount it plays, you know? And if with golf playing, say, 50 tournaments, or the PGA Tour playing 50 tournaments, 4 days a tournament, they effectively have 200 games, you know?
Yeah,
they have more games than professional baseball. That's wild.
Yeah. One just rolls into another. I mean, you could probably forsake the John Deere Classic for the Scottish Open and make the Scottish Open a PGA Tour event. Mm-hmm. That would be certainly much more interesting.
Yeah. And this is not a shot at the John Deere Classic. They run a great event there. But I think the other thing, too, is, like, why not have it rotate? Like, you know, I'm in Chicago. We don't have an event this year. You know, we didn't have an event last year, obviously. And, you know, we don't have a regular event. We're the third biggest, probably second biggest golf market in the country. You know, we don't have a regular event, but, like, if one of these 20 events, say it's 25 events, top players, if they rotated all around the world, it would be incredible.
How can Chicago not have a PGA Tour event?
Well, Boston doesn't have one. Chicago doesn't have one. Philadelphia doesn't have one. Washington, D.C. doesn't have one. It's absolute madness.
That's amazing. Well, yeah. Well, having said that, there is no German Open anymore, which is pretty incredible. But I forgot what I was going to say. Going back to the PGA, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, you almost know it's never going to happen. But once every 4 years, every Olympic year, the PGA ought to go outside of the United States. Now, that should become the world major. And I guarantee you in 50 years' time, it would go from being the unloved fourth major, despite the fact it's got the best field of all the majors. Mm-hmm. It would go from being the unloved fourth major, certainly outside of America. I mean, people care about the PGA in Australia, but nowhere near as much as they care about the British Open, the US Open, or the Masters. If you took it outside and you played in Japan, you played at Royal Melbourne, you played in Paris, it would in 50 years' time, I guarantee you, it'd be the most loved major. It'd be massive.
That's the thing. Yeah, none of them rotate outside of their country, which would be, you know, you essentially be able to make it almost Olympics. It make it more feel like the golf's Olympic. Well, I got good news for you. There's an open PGA Championship date in 2030. Maybe that could be the first one.
Even if they didn't do it, it would be interesting if they just opened their mind to the possibility of doing it.
Yeah, just open.
The US PGA is in America and that's it. Well, it's like, what about once every 8 years even? Just take it outside. Take it out. Again, if you were starting again, you would never play three of the four majors in the United States. You would do what they do in tennis.
Yeah.
And it's about the only thing tennis does better than golf is they play four majors in four completely distinct and different cities. And they've each got their own personality and they're all such great events.
That's, you know, just an interesting parallel on top of your tennis comparison. Just the state of tennis today and golf today is that it's ironic that tennis is the sport where, you know, the stars make all the money. Number 80 on the tennis money list can barely pay his bills, you know. And then you look at golf and you know, number 125 on the FedEx Cup's making $1.2 million. And, you know, each sport, tennis is now looking at golf as a more manageable model for their pay. And golf is looking at tennis. The stars of golf are looking at tennis saying, we need to get paid more.
Well, you know, if the stars of golf want to talk to Paul McNamee, who's a great tennis mind, who was a tournament director of the Australian Open for 15 years, Wimbledon doubles champion, 25 in the world in singles. You know, if they want to talk to someone about a broken model in sport, then talk to Paul about tennis. I mean, he's in despair at the fact that the 120th player in tennis can't make a living. Yeah. Anyway, I think 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was one tournament, say it was in Monte Carlo, it's a 64 draw, I think. It's the only tennis tournament in the world. He looks at golf and says, they're playing in Europe, they're playing in Japan, they're playing in America. There are 1,000 guys making a living out of golf, and there are, you know, if you get in the Grand Slams, it's $100,000 to lose first round. So you're guaranteed $400,000 for the year. But if you're not in those, bad luck. So he coached Su Wei Shay, who the Taiwanese woman player who made the quarterfinal in the Australian Open, number one in doubles. She was qualifying for a singles tournament a month ago. So how can she be qualifying? She made the last eight in the Australian Open. She's qualifying? She's qualifying. I mean, tennis is such a broken model, horrendous model, if you're a player. But for Federer and Nadal, it's brilliant. Yeah. Djokovic, I think, is, you know, Djokovic is the good guy who's trying to break it up and kind of, you know, but from my reading of it, he's the one in there who's trying to at least get the players who aren't the absolute elite getting paid a living wage. So golf would be well advised not to follow the tennis model.
Well, that's the thing is if you get all the way over to tennis, like think about how many careers get cut short of players who might end up being great because they can't, you know, you might be the 100th best player in the world, you know, like the mini tour player, just to say, yeah, you know what? I need to do something else for a living and call it quits. And that person might then 2 years later be a better tennis player than they were before, you know?
Yeah. And you can bet that, yeah, you can bet the 200th best tennis player in the world is a pretty good player. Mm-hmm. Sure, he looks pretty good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, as we both know, the 200th best golfer in the world, sure, he's not the best player in the world, but you go watch him hit balls in the range, he's pretty darn good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you watch any of the top 500 players hit balls on the range, they all look pretty good. The thing is, Phil probably looks about the worst if you watch him hit balls on the range.
Yeah. Well,
that was the amazing thing. His range session before that final round was horrendous. I mean, it was all over the place. I was talking with my buddy who's the teaching pro who made the cut, and he goes, I can't believe this. I mean, he's hitting it all over the map. He was just beside himself about how bad Phil's range session was. He was like, I had a better range session than Phil. And Phil had a club break. He's got Tip Mickelson's running back. His coach was giving him instruction. And then he goes out and plays like pretty damn good round.
Sometimes that's a good thing, though. I always thought the worst range session you could have was the one where you flushed every shot. And sometimes the best ones are when you couldn't hit it at all.
Yeah.
Which makes no sense at all. But, you know, it was always a bad sign if you were flushing it on every shot. And in fact, you get to the point where, let me just hit a few bad ones here because this is not good. Yeah. This is not going to turn out well.
One of my best days on the course, I meddled in this mid-am thing, I was really hungover, and I was batting it around all over the place on the range. And I made two good swings at the end of the range session, and then I didn't miss a shot all day. But like the range session in the middle of it, I was thinking about not even going and playing.
Now for a quick word from our other sponsor. BeDratty. Longtime supporter of the podcast and the website, BeDratty is another great option for Father's Day. You know, it's right around the corner, and they want to have you covered. So they have all kinds of sorts of great gear. Obviously, they've got the Liam Polo, the Peruvian Pima cotton that we've talked about on this podcast. Softest cotton shirt in the game, you know, awesome shirt that you can transition right from the golf course to almost any setting in. You know, will be probably one of your most favorite golf shirt from the day you get it. You know, with it being middle of summer, obviously you could get a little perspiration out on the golf course. And in the last 2 years, they've been developed their sport line. I highly recommend this stuff. When it's, you know, 90 degrees, this is my go-to, the BeDratty Sports. They are available on the website. They have, you know, shirts, hoodies, all sorts of different stuff in the sport line. You know, with summer here, get some new sports shirts. You know, get some shirts for when it's 95. Be comfortable. They're kind of like an air conditioner out there. So if you use the promo code TFEDAD, that's TFEDAD at BeDratty.com, you'll get 30% off your entire order. That's a lot of money. You know, 30% off is pretty good. That's a discount we can't even give at the Fried Egg. You know, 30% off would make us lose money on gear. So use TFE Dad for 30% off at beachready.com and stock up on some great Beach Ready sport gear or whatever, you know, fits your fancy. They got tons of great gear on that site. So beachready.com. And now back to Mike Clayton.
What are you working on? You got anything exciting going on from the architecture side of things?
Yeah, Mike DeVries is down in September, October. We start on Matt Goggins' course at 7 Mile Beach in Hobart. Mm-hmm. So I was playing with Matt about 25 years ago. He just turned pro. He said, there's an amazing bit of land in Hobart. I just started in the golf course design business. He said, there's an amazing piece of land in Hobart. I've been playing on it since I was a kid. I'm going to build a golf course on it one day. Yeah, okay, fine. So he got us down to look at it about 10 years ago. It's the most incredible site. And I'm sure golf architects say this all the time, but it's Pine Valley in the sand dunes on the ocean. It's incredible. So after 10 years, he's finally gotten that going. So we start there in September. So that's a kind of really cool job. So DeVries is flying down with his wife to live in Hobart for a year, and we're going to build that. So that's kind of the...
How does the site compare with Barboogle, since you're part of that?
I think it's, as much as great as Barboogle was, I think it's better because it's got trees on it, which they're clearing now. But, we're going to leave a bunch of trees on it. It's bigger, wider, and broader. So the site of Barboogle was on that really narrow strip that, the definition of a links between the ocean and the farmland. And the farmland at Barboogle was the worst bit of land you've ever seen for building golf. It's flat mud where Richard Sattler grazes cows on. But that little narrow strip of sand dunes was what we had. And it was perfect for golf, but it was narrow and long, whereas there's any amount of space at 7 Mile Beach. So you can go in any direction. You can break up the directions of the holes. There's no limit on the space. In fact, it's big enough to build 4 golf courses on it.
Wow.
So it's much different from Barboogle and better from the sense that there's just more space and you're not constricted. And it was no impediment to building the greatest course in the world at St Andrews that it was on a narrow strip of land that went up and down. But I think it's arguably better if you've got more space and more land to spread out.
Yeah, it makes the routing process a little tougher,
Well, it does because, we kind of found the clubhouse site really early on. There was one really obvious place to put it. And you can go in any direction and find a great hole. And then once you've found that one great hole, you can just step across 5 yards and go in any direction and find another great hole. So we'll never know if we've got the best routing. It would be impossible to know if you ever had the best routing. We've had so many routings there over the years, but I think we've got a pretty good one.
How do you go about that? Do you look for the best long holes, knowing that the par threes are the easiest ones to find?
Yeah, you do because the par three you can find a great par three anywhere.
And par threes can get you out of tough spots too.
Yeah, out of little tricky corners. That's exactly right. So I think it was Nicholas who said, on a good bit of land, all you see is par fives, and a bad bit of land, all you see is par threes. So this is a little mix of both. There are some really cool par threes, but there are lots of long runs of holes where I don't think there's a par four on the course, apart from the ones that head down towards the beach, that you couldn't stretch out into making a par five. Mm-hmm. So it's just it's a bit like, imagine sandhills with trees. You've played sandhills, I assume?
Yeah, oh yeah. That's,
yeah.
So you got me excited. I might have to just move to Australia. Yeah. Are they accepting new citizens?
Well, not right now. Well, Australia's not accepting anyone at the moment. In fact, there are 40,000 Australians who are outside Australia who can't even get back home. So, but once this pandemic's over, hopefully, the great thing for
it'll be easier to get to than Barboogle too, right? Because it's near Hobart, right?
What's 5 minutes from Hobart Airport?
Oh my god!
So it's incredibly easy to get to. So it's hard to imagine when you say it's 5 minutes from an airport. People just assume, well, the land possibly can't be any good because it's obviously dead flat. And I mean, it's literally 5 minutes from the airport. It's a spit of land going out into the water, covered in sand dunes. It's amazing land. So that's kind of my next year's project for the next year, really, which is really exciting.
We'll get you out of the beach house.
Well, we'll get us out of the beach house. But the amazing thing about Hobart was the best course in Hobart was probably the 80th best course in Australia, Royal Hobart. Uh-huh. And then Bunboogle got built, then Lost Farm, then Cape Wickham. And once Seven Mile Beach gets done, you know, if we don't screw it up, they'll arguably have four of the best six courses in Australia, in Tasmania, which is pretty amazing. So it's, you know, it's become a huge tourist pull for the island. You know,
it looks like Tasmania and Hobart. Hobart looks like a beautiful city too.
Yeah, it is. It's right in the water. It's not. I mean, we complain about the weather, but you know, someone in Hobart complaining about the weather to someone who lives in Chicago, they would just laugh at us.
What do they complain about? What's the weather like?
Oh, they would complain about 55 or 60 degrees. Oh,
God. You know, my dream is to live somewhere where when I put a jacket on, I'm warm, like one jacket.
And probably there's no day in Hobart when you can't play golf.
Ah.
There'd be 10 or 15 days where it wouldn't be much fun. It'd be windy and cold. But you can play golf every day. You know, so Melbourne weather's probably better than Hobart. But people from Queensland, which is our Florida, way to the north, which is your south, go nuts about Melbourne's weather. I mean, there's no better climate for golf in the world than Melbourne. It's an amazing climate for golf. Because, there's almost literally never a day when you can't play golf in Melbourne.
Yeah, like in the winter, do the trees, like I only hear of people going to Australia in the winter, or in our winter, your summer. Like, do the courses actually play better? Because, like, would the kikuyu die out and would it be less sticky a lot of places?
Well, there's kikuyu in Sydney. There's no kikuyu in Melbourne. So we have Bermuda fairways all year round now. The ball runs further in the winter. The fairways go dormant, but the courses play pretty much the same.
I mean, like, the courses in Pinehurst play way better in the winter than they play in the summer. Because the Bermuda goes dormant at the places that don't overseed.
Yeah, so it doesn't play better, but it doesn't play any worse. And the courses look better in summer because they're greener, and the dormant is a bit dank. I mean, I love brown, but it's a danky kind of brown rather than a burned off Hoy Lake brown.
Okay,
which is really cool. But I mean, Hobart's perfect because it's cold enough to grow fescue. So all the fairways in Hobart in Tasmania are fescue. All the new course fairways, really? Bunboogle, Wickham,
so
Seven Mile Beach.
You're going to do fescue down there too.
Yeah. Yeah. So fescue is, by far the best grass to play golf on. Bunboogle is the best conditioned course in Australia year round because it's so great to play there in the winter.
Got to get down there. Maybe 2022. I'm at the point where it needs to be a month. So, you know, that's just the reality of the situation.
Yeah, which is going to be January, February. So there's a potential to have two really cool events in Melbourne in January and February. But then you follow on with the Vic Open, which is a mixed LPGA European Tour event. Then go to the Women's Open in Adelaide. So in a couple of years' time, it'll be easy to do a month down here.
Yeah. All right. Mike, it's always great chatting. We'll talk soon, and looking forward to 7 Mile Beach.
Thanks, mate. Great fun. See you later.
All right, Will and Garrett. This is a rare three-person in-person pod.
This is unprecedented, actually.
First time ever.
This has never happened before.
Well, the Fried Egg crew is rarely in the same place at the same time anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially in the last year, you know. Hired Will. Live in the same city. I didn't see him for 6 months. Anyways, lots going on in the golf world. We were here, Garrett. You were flying. You were in the air while the U.S. Women's Open was going on. Wanted to chit chat about what happened. Obviously, it was a historic U.S. Open, being at the Olympic Club for the first time in the history of the U.S. Women's Open, a course that's hosted 10 other USGA championships. And then with the Lexi Thompson collapse there down the final nine, Yuka Sasso became the youngest tying MB Park, the youngest U.S. Women's Open champ ever at 19 years old. And some days that was a great Justin Ray stat, down to the day, tied the youngest U.S. Open champ. Pretty crazy. Then you could get into technicalities about time of birth as well as, you know, hour that they won.
Have we looked into this?
I don't know if anybody has.
We'll leave that to Justin.
All right, Justin. Yeah,
definitely not in my wheelhouse. So, what did you think about the tournament? What were your takeaways from the tournament?
Two things. The first is the slow drip of mistakes Lexi made down the stretch. Just each one of them, you kind of felt it coming, but it was still really hard to watch. Second,
it was like an unraveling. Like, that's something that you just, I think, like anybody that's played tournament golf, and even like anybody that's
anybody who's
really
played golf,
like in a competitive setting, fuel. Club champion. This is having caddied in so many club championships in my life. Like, I've seen that movie so many times where things are seemingly, like, in the player's mind, they're going in fast forward, but you as a viewer are watching them in slow motion.
Yep. And you could see her brain, like, really start moving quickly, but she was trying to laugh it off. But each time she stepped up in a pivotal moment where she could either gain momentum or at least avoid losing two shots in one case, or at least making bogey, is like, no, like, you are not going to be able to execute this. And for a world-class player that she is, it was really hard to watch.
Yeah, it just seemed like, obviously, the prodigious distance is the real thing that makes her game, why she's a top 10 player, is how well she drives the golf ball, how far she hits it. It, in a way, it almost seemed like, when the pressure gets the most, you know, when you feel the most pressure, all of your weaknesses are the things that become very apparent. And it, like, she's obviously a world-class player. We're talking about one of the, you know, a player that's been in the top 10 of the world rankings for nearly a decade. It really seemed like the things that have haunted her over a career, namely her putter, were very exposed down the stretch there.
I don't think anyone would classify Lexi as a grinder necessarily. She's a very good player. But when things start moving quickly and you need to really score and continue the momentum, that just seems like where she has struggled in the past. And that was exposed again this week.
Yeah. And I think an underrated part of the meltdown was that it really started with missing a bunch of fairways. Like, she was just battling back from the rough a lot down the stretch. And everybody points to that chip, the flub chip at 11, as the moment when things really started to go wrong. And I think that's right. You know, things really did go wrong after that, and that was a very bad shot. But that was precipitated by her missing the fairway and this just being able to hack up to the point that she chipped from. And she kept doing that. Her bad holes on the back nine, a lot of them were missing the fairway, getting a kind of crappy lie, and just being able to do a little bit. And that put a lot of pressure on her short game and her putting. And obviously, when you applied that pressure to her short game and putting, she just wasn't making those 10 footers or getting it really close from off the green.
I think that's the thing. You look at the leaderboard, and Lexi was hitting, she was hitting the driver so spectacularly
well
through through really 63 holes of the tournament, and that back nine is where it unraveled. But then you look across the leaderboard at the other players in contention, and they were hitting tons of fairways. Nasa, Shenshen were hitting tons of fairways. And Yuka Sasa wasn't, but she was arguably had the best short game week of any player in the field. And if you're not going to, and that was the whole thing with Olympic is you better hit fairways.
Right.
You have to hit fairways. And we saw that kind of play out. You have to hit fairways. And if you don't hit fairways, you have to have a supremely great week around the greens. And I think Lexi and Yuka Sasso were two players that could afford to miss more fairways because of their length and strength, like we've seen in the men's game with Brooks and Bryson. But I don't think it's at the level yet of the men's game where they can just completely overpower a course. Like, that rough still has a tremendous impact in the women's game.
Right. And like when they're missing fairways, I mean, say they have 160 yards. When Bryson is able to muscle some sort of wedge that far, it's way different when you're hitting 7 or 8 iron. When Alexi has an incredible amount of clubhead speed, but just the amount, there's the additional loft that Bryson is able to use through there just makes that much bigger of a difference.
Yeah. Will, did you have a second thing?
Yeah. The second thing, on a more positive note, was just the true excitement from everyone in the field to go to Olympic Club. Well, I'm sure you guys have your takes on the golf course and we can get to those, but I think a good point made by someone in our DMs this week was asking if they can be in on a host venue as a place, but not necessarily in on it as a golf course. And for the women's game to go somewhere like Olympic Club, I think for the players, for the fans, for some of the media that strictly follows women's golf, I think that was an exciting opportunity for them. And the USGA is doing a lot better job of that moving forward.
Right.
But like looking back on Pinehurst in 2014, there was a lot of excitement around that week. And I think we kind of saw the same thing this week.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the place versus golf course idea will come up again when we go to Torrey Pines.
Yes.
It's like, that's absolutely a cool place, has a lot of history. You know, there's obviously a lot of great things about it. The golf course isn't very good. But with Olympic Club, at least what you have is some interesting stuff going on with the golf course and a real priority put on ball striking by the slope of the property. And, you know, a lot of what we're talking about so far feeds into what my main takeaway is, and that's that the U.S. Women's Open is now the real U.S. Open. Like, when John Bodenhammer talks about what the U.S. Open is supposed to be, what it represents, you know, this the challenging test that is supposed to be
the full examination
of a player's game, I don't think that they can really do that anymore with the modern men's game, right? They're different things have to be done to the golf course in order for the scores to be higher, and you know, and kind of goofy things happen when you get to that edge. But with the women's game right now, and I'm not sure if this is always going to be the case, right? We had a 14-year-old this week who is hitting the ball 300, so like, I don't know.
I think that's
but right now with the women's game, this is a real U.S. Open. What the U.S. Open is supposed to be, that's what we saw this week. Now, whether you like that or not, that's up to you, but this was a real U.S. Open.
I think that's the thing, is I think that what I would say is that the USGA's philosophy on setup and how they look at a golf course and think about testing a player, I think their philosophy works tremendously for the women's game, and it does no longer, the men's game has evolved to the point where they need to present different problems for the best players.
Yes.
And I don't know if the USGA is nimble or enough at this point to even know that they've just made it a one-dimensional who hits it the furthest test, which I would wager, if I was a wagering man, a fair sum of money is what's going to unfold at Torrey Pines. It's the same thing that unfolded at Wingfoot. And it's the same thing that's unfolded at almost every U.S. Open, men's open, for the last 8 years. While, you know, it was amazing at the U.S. Women's Open, we had such a wide variety of players. And that we had Nasa, who's more of a control player, a shorter hitter, you know, playing, you know, in a playoff with Yuka Sasso, who's one of the longest hitters. We had Lexi, a bomber. We had Shen Feng, who's a very much a control player, who, you know, through 12 holes had hit every fairway and every green in regulation. You know,
that's
hit
wild.
Every single fairway until she hit 13 of 14 fairways, two rounds at Olympic Club. Like, I couldn't even fathom doing that. And where we're still at a level where in the women's game, where, you know, precision players can tangle with power players on a narrow and long rough golf course.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And going back to, I mean, another thing that the USGA prides themselves on is that everyone has a chance. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, we saw Megha Gane and Maya Stark both finish top 20. They both were in the mix, quote unquote, on Sunday. Like, yes, the women's game, you start earlier in your professional career, but just seeing two amateurs in quote unquote contention, like, it, you can really qualify for this as an amateur and have a legitimate chance if you have the week of your life.
Yeah. Maya Stark didn't get enough coverage. I mean, obviously, Megha Gane was the big amateur story, but Maya Stark has been on a tear this summer. She's been showing up in a lot of different places. She's a
NCAA's,
hell of a player.
The Anwa. Yeah. Really great player. I think one of the things was that she, you know, Megha Gane was in the final group versus Maya Stark, who started the day eight shots back.
And was tied for the lead the first 2 days.
Right.
I mean, an incredible story. Andy, did you have any particular takeaways that are different from what we've been talking about so far?
I think we've seen some of the golf world shift, and I think that's been exciting. I think, like, No Laying Up's done like a wonderful job covering the women's game and generating more interest. And I think just as we look forward, I think, you know, the women's game's on like a really great trajectory up, and I think there's more interest than ever. And I think we're, you know, with the USGA really prioritizing venues and getting the women playing the best venues, you know, Pebble Beach in 2 years is going to be unbelievable for the women's game. But I think this needs to have a trickle down effect at the LPGA level and really pushing. I think, you know, being out there on site on the ground, you know, I think one of the biggest takeaways I had was just how refreshing the players were, how open and willing they were to talk, how engaging they were with fans during the week of the tournament. You know, we saw Lexi signing autographs after she just had one of the, you know, probably worst meltdowns in golf history on the golf course. Like, you know, it's just, to me, such a more, you know, it's a product that you're really, it makes me excited about covering more and more in the future. And I think just in general, I think it should be way more popular than it is. And I'm happy to see, like, I felt like it really owned Sunday on, you know, modern social media outlet. Like, I think on Twitter, it really was the dominant tournament, which was neat to see up against, you know, the Memorial, who had two top 15 players in a playoff.
And all sorts of distracting stuff going on at the Memorial. It was almost like it was engineered to try to divert attention back to the PGA Tour, with the Bryson and Brooks stuff on Friday, and obviously that John Rahm having to withdraw was a big story, and, you know, that wasn't a joke. But it was great nonetheless, to, even though these big stories were unfolding on the PGA Tour, the interest in the U.S. Women's Open was sustained throughout the weekend. And I think the venue has a lot to do with that. I think people were excited to see the top women in the world play Olympic Club. And obviously, as you mentioned, the players were super excited to go there. You know, for this podcast that I did for Friday Stories, I talked to, you know, Julie Inkster and Lucy Lee. Lucy Lee ended up having a pretty good week at Olympic Club. She got through the qualifier that I was covering. And both of them answered the question about, you know, what was important to you about this U.S. Women's Open in exactly the same way. They said, Olympic Club. I have had this circled on my schedule for years. I've been looking forward to this tournament, going to this venue for years. And this was really, really important to me and to women's golf. They were both on that theme. Lucy Lee being 18 years old, right? And still having that perspective. And obviously Julie Inkster being at the end of her career. And she was like, I got to try to qualify for this. This is a big deal. And so I think that was a huge part of it, for sure.
And you and Andy both have talked about this in the past, but prioritizing venues not only in major championships, but across the LPGA Tour could like really boom interest. I mean, they're doing a lot better job. I mean, infusing Lake Merced and Inverness Club last year. They went to Shadow Creek just recently. Just getting places where the casual golf fan would be interested in seeing, and even PGA Tour fans, getting the both players and media fans all excited about going to places, I think only helps everyone increase their interest in each event.
One other thing that I meant to talk about at the top, I think Yuka Sasso could be a transformational player for the women's game and LPGA Tour. I think, obviously, youngest women's open winner, you know, tying Imbi Park, who's won 7 majors, I believe. And I think with Sasso, the thing that is intoxicating is when you see her swing the club, it looks different, but in a familiar way, where, you know, I think most golf fans would say, short of Tiger, the person they most want to see swing a golf club is Rory McIlroy. It's the most, it's like poetic. It's beautiful. It's so rhythmic and just so effortlessly powerful. And here's Yuka Sasso, who famously learned, you know, to swing a golf club by watching Rory McIlroy YouTube videos. And it was cool to see Rory engaging with Yuka Sasso, you know, putting it up on Instagram and Twitter about, like, you know, interacting. But I think I was with some buddies, some college buddies that aren't big golf fans, and the women's game, Saturday, the women's golf came on Golf Channel, and they saw the swing, and their reaction was like, who's that? You know? And I think that her presence on that tour and potential to be, you know, one of the 5 big players could really, you know, shift the conversation, and I think just open some eyes as to like how talented the rest of the tour is, because she has that golf swing that's just, you know, you can't take your eyes off it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's something about it that, I mean, it's obviously catnip for the aggregators, this Yuka, Rory. I mean, it's very charming. The way Rory has engaged has been great, and what she has said about it has been great. I think at some point we need to get beyond the Yuka Rory thing and talk more about who Yuka Sasso is, because I think she's a really interesting person. And Andy, you and Brendan dug into her backstory quite a bit for the shotgun start. And I thought that should get as much attention as the Rory similarities. But when you see her release, the way she turns through the ball and releases the club, to me, it is very similar to Rory. You know, it really has that. The thing that's thrilling about Rory's swing is the way I feel he releases the club, how it's so free, right?
Yeah.
And she does the same thing.
And I think that golf swing can be, it's like, you know, when you watch a swing, it makes you want to know more about that person, especially when you see a swing like that. I don't know. I've never, like, it's hard to really put to words what it is, but when you see certain golf swings, it makes you just like, you want more. And I think that she has the opportunity to do that, not only for her own, like, you know, own fans, but also for women's golf.
Mm-hmm. And adding to that, I mean, I think everyone deserves a chance to, or not deserves, everyone should just watch and like see the similarities between the swings. But I think the other thing she might have learned from Rory is just like the confidence and swagger that she carries on the golf course is intoxicating. I mean, even when she was making mistakes, she still seemed like she was in control of her emotions out there. And that's something that Rory does very well when he's kind of bouncing around the golf course. And she did that on the back nine when she felt Lexi coming down on her. She started making birdies on 16, 17. She knew that that wasn't her opportunity.
It's funny. I think part of it is the glasses, but I felt like there was like a Hideki Matsuyama, like deadpan, like, you know, demeanor where you could look at her and you wouldn't know if things were unraveling or if things were going really well. Like that's kind of just the feel I had for her was like, you know, this kind of like to hang in there at 19 after starting double or 6-6.
Yeah.
Incredible. Like, I mean, she played flawless golf, you know, the last 12 or so holes. And especially down the stretch, she was so good. I don't think many 19-year-olds would hang in there after that. That she must have felt so awful going to the third hole, right?
And then she made double there too, I think.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah.
Double.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, I mean
double.
One of the most amazing final round recoveries I can remember for mm-hmm. sure. And I don't know. So, I mean, I'd like to know more about Yuka Saso. I mean, I learned a lot, as I mentioned, from the segment that Andy and Brendan did on her and get a sense for her personality. But I thought that one of the key facts of her biography is that she was born in the Philippines, obviously, right? Had a Filipina mother and a Japanese father. And when she was about 4 years old, 5 years old, the family moved to Japan.
Yeah.
And what Saso, I believe, has talked about is that she felt lonely, as a kid would, you know, moving to a new country and felt that she wasn't really able to make friends that well, didn't speak the language that well. And that's when her interest in golf really started to take off. And the way she talks about her interest in golf, watching YouTube videos, is to me the way that someone who is sort of introverted and internal, someone who is you know, comfortable pursuing interests on their own alone, would engage with the game. So to me, that the interesting thing that about her looking at Rory videos isn't the Rory thing, isn't the uncanny emulation of that swing. It's the fact that in her free time, she's looking up YouTube videos and going down the rabbit hole and trying to learn things. Honestly, not all golfers are like that, right? Yeah. A lot of golfers learn the game more socially from teachers or from peers out on the golf course. Here's Yuka at home, right? A little bit lonely in a new country, looking up YouTube videos. Yeah. And I think that to me gives her a personality that I personally can connect with and that makes sense given what we saw out on the course at Olympic.
I think one of the things too that makes me a little sad is last year during the US Women's Open, I did a flashback for the shotgun start on Sayree Pack's first win, or first US Women's Open win, and you know, kind of tied to what happened in South Korea with women's golf after that. It was just like this explosion of interest, and all the talent we see today is really the Sayree era from there. And there was just one of the things that was there was like these great Sports Illustrated archive articles, these profiles on Pac, like and one of the things that stinks at this point with golf in general is that we're missing those. And yeah, and I mean, are. I run a golf media outlet, but there's just like economically feasible, it's not feasible to send a writer to,
can know, I go the to Philippines,
to write a Yuka Saso article.
Right.
You know, but like, that's the thing I think that's missing a little bit, especially from the women's game, is the storytelling around these players and their backgrounds. And, you know, maybe the future's in audio, maybe, but the, you know, being able to read, I think it was Jaime Diaz write about Sayree and, you know, everything she's done for the game and in South Korea and what it's like. Like, I don't think we're going to know or really hear a ton about what it's going to do for the game in the Philippines when Yuka goes back there, or, you know, what, you know, how inspirational it's going to be. But I would imagine that we're going to see a boom. Like, this is huge. Like, they, yeah, the, in that spotlight, Brenda did incredible research, but when she won the, I can't remember, like, the Asian Junior Games, it was like a massive deal in the country. She became a celebrity.
It
in,
was her and
long hitter.
Yeah, Bianca yeah. Pagnadanganon.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think is how you pronounce her name.
So that's pretty good.
But she's right, who was making headlines earlier this year because she's out on tour and just hitting it past everybody.
Yeah, I think she might be leading driving distance.
Hitting it past Lexi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely, there is a hole now because we don't have a Jaime Diaz going to the Philippines and figuring out what it means that Yuka Saso just won there.
You don't have anything anywhere doing that, which, you know.
We're just going to reheat. Are we going to reheat the Rory stuff over and over? The next time Yuka Saso does something amazing, are we going to get more Rory stuff? Because, I mean, I get it. I get why that's interesting. But it would just be too bad if we were that lazy, to, you know, about finding more interesting stuff to say.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing, well, not the only thing, but some of the interesting things to come out of this was similar to when Hideki won and some of the Japanese newspapers were depicting his every golf shot that he put on the front page. It's the six top Filipino newspapers all had her on the front page after her win.
Oh yeah.
And that's just so cool and something that wouldn't, I mean, there might be like a small blurb on like the front of the New York Times when someone wins the Masters, but it's not the story of the day. And I think that's something that everyone is starting to realize with as this incredible Asian crop of players continues to, well, and starts to dominate the women's game. And
already dominating.
Yeah, dominates the women's game.
I mean,
one
more
up.
Major goes by and an American player does not win.
Yeah, and I mean, we saw it with Hideki and we saw it with Yuka. Like, it's a huge deal for them. And LPGA numbers are great. That's why they continue to host this Asian Swing. And
I feel a little bit for the country of Japan, because how cool would it have been to have Hideki win, you know, the Masters, arguably the biggest event in men's golf, and then Nasa Hataoka win the biggest event in women's golf, the U.S. Women's Open, right in leading into the Olympics, would have been pretty insane.
To what extent does or can Japan claim a piece of Yuka Saso?
That's true.
I mean, you know, it's clearly where she started learning the game. And so I think the enthusiasm for golf in Japan has something to do with her ability in the game. And it has to, right?
I think you might have to ask a Texan that. You know, where are they, Texan or American?
Yeah,
you know,
we need to ask, question. Can Hideki win is what we need to do.
He's gone, but, though.
Yeah. Can Hideki win is gone?
He's just taking Twitter. A break, yeah.
No way. This is news to me.
Yeah, he said this. He said his goodbyes.
This is very unfortunate.
We should also mention that Tsubasa Kajitani also won the ANWA. So, I mean, it really was, we were very close to three huge golf wins for Japan. Yeah. Oh, I mean, four kind of with Yuka. But
that's, you know, and this, one of the things that I love also about women's golf is how big of a deal the Olympics is. They haven't reached the level of, you know, the monetary level of the men's game that, you know, has allowed the Olympics, the arguably the greatest athletic achievement in sports, being an Olympian, you know, become irrelevant in, you know,
and a busy schedule.
Yeah, a busy schedule and a contrived FedEx Cup playoffs being prioritized. With the women's game, the Olympics is one of the four or five biggest events of a year. I would argue that it, you know, next to the U.S. Women's Open, might be the biggest event of the year, because these women know being an Olympic gold medalist would open them into a whole new stratosphere of endorsements.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is a huge monetary reward for them. And, you know, MB Park, Mike Wan on this podcast said, talked about like the ratings MB Park garnered in, I think Tiger, when he won the Masters, was an 8 and an 8 rating. And MB Park winning the Olympics in South Korea was a 24 rating, which is absolutely insane. But, you know, this all the best women will be at the Olympics, which I think is a really neat thing. And obviously the Olympics is kind of a dicey situation at this point with COVID but it sounds like golf, you know, and the Olympics are a go, and right. And it, that'll be an amazing event later this year to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, what would be a great story is Nasa Hadaoka winning.
Or Shibuno.
Winning in Japan. Yeah, but, you know, Nasa Hadaoka, real quick, 22 years old, absolute baller, 5 top 10s in majors since 2018. She's been in the mix a lot. I think she's one of those great iron players who's gonna be there in big tournaments, who's going to play hard courses well.
That was the thing I noticed, too, is like Megan Kang.
Mm-hmm.
Top 5 last year at the U.S. Women's Open and top 5 this year. And, you know, you look at her results other places and you just don't make sense. And then you watch Megan Kang play at Olympic. It was an absolute stripe show. I mean, she was unbelievable. I could not believe the shots that I was watching. Like, you know, every single time it just seemed she was just knocking down flag after flag with mid and long irons. It's like, oh, like she's quite good. And maybe I think this is the detriment of the golf course selection by the LPGA. You know, from what I gather, it's very, very heavily dictated, more so than the PGA Tour, based on sponsors. If the sponsor says we want to sponsor this, this is where we're hosting it. And I think, you know, it's hard because, you know, the sponsor interest isn't the same as the PGA Tour, but like, I think the tour needs to be like, this is where we want to host it. Yeah. Will you, you know, can we agree on this? You know?
And there's even some media pressure to make the courses easier.
I mean, I thought that this week illustrated so many of the great skills of the players that were in contention.
Absolutely. It showed them in the best light possible. Was anybody saying, oh, Yuka Sasso is not a very good golfer because she only shot 4 under at Olympic Club? No. They saw Yuka Sasso pulling off incredibly difficult shots under incredibly difficult circumstances.
And that's the thing, is like that short game skill, she would have gotten it up and down all over the place anywhere last week. But everybody else would have gotten it up and down significantly more often. What she was able to do was separate herself because of her skills and be extraordinary around the greens, where other people's average was considerably less effective.
Yeah. Any Lexi takes? Should we talk about Lexi?
What does
this mean at this point? Right. Cause this was this felt like a fork in the road, right? If she wins this is a great, you know, sort of second stage of her career. She's only 26, right? But she's been around for forever. She qualified for the U.S. Women's Open when she was 11. And I don't know, this just felt like a really, really devastating setback.
It doesn't feel like she should only have one major. I'm trying to think of like a comparison on the PGA Tour, but to play in 50 PGA champion or 50 major championships and only have one win just doesn't seem right for someone of her caliber and
Dustin
standing
Johnson
in the game.
Pre-2020 Masters, maybe.
Yeah.
She doesn't win a lot, though. She doesn't win a lot on the, like, she's had a very long career. Like, it's not like she wins a ton. Like, this is not somebody like DJ going out and winning 4 or 5 events a year, every year. Like, she wins 1, 2 events a year. Like a good year is 2 events. Like she racks up high finishes, but I think this is maybe like the comparisons like Adam Scott, and both of them are plagued by an extremely bulky putter that just seemingly held them back. And you know, I think that could be the comparison, is where you look at Adam Scott and it's like, how is it possible this man only won yeah. major championship?
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Then you see the 2 putters in his bag, and you're like, that's
like
why.
Adam Scott never won prolifically on the PGA that's Tour true. Either. Like, yeah. He's won a lot, but he's 40 plus years old and he's been out there since he's 19.
Yeah.
Like, when you put it in that perspective, it's like, oh, he's won 1 tournament a year for 20 plus years. Yeah. I think I would lean that way more. And there's a lot of skeletons in that closet now with the bad finishes. She had a really bad one at the Tour Championship a few years ago, missing. I think she missed like a 2-footer for a win. And
That was 2017. That was her bad 2017. 2-footer for the Tour Championship, missed it. And then, of course, that was the year at the A&A Inspiration when she was doing some things with her ball mark and got a 4-stroke penalty, basically, and lost that.
I at a certain point, those, like, it's that great Patrick Harrington quote from the PGA is like, experience isn't all it's cracked up to be. Like, with experience, you lose innocence. Mm-hmm. And I think the coverage like to lean on how great of a learning experience this would be when you've been playing professional golf for as long as she has out there. Obviously, considering shorter LPGA careers, when you've been playing golf, when you're a veteran, that's not experience. That's a skeleton.
Yeah.
You know,
that scar tissue. Yeah, I mean, Will, you played a lot of junior golf and through college. You obviously saw a lot of good players coming up. You know, maybe some were better when they were juniors than they were later on. I mean, what do you think the effect is of somebody like Lexi Thompson really becoming an elite world class player at 11 years old, becoming famous? And then, I don't know, I mean, she sort of has plateaued, but do you see that a lot where kids who are really great, really young, just have a hard time kind of transitioning into adulthood?
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes back to the drive that Yuka Sasso has. Like, I mean, we know Lexi is a very hard worker. She's in the gym all the time, and she's always at, I think, Bears Club is where she's a member. And, I mean, she obviously cares a ton. It is interesting to think about having gotten that good that early and what drives you to continually get better. We know she obviously wants majors here, but now this is the second time in 3 years that she's gotten either she had the lead or she was one back, I think, at the 2019 U.S. Women's Open at Country Club of Charleston. And it's like, when you're under the gun, do you have the experience to rely on that you can kind of close this out? And 50 majors in, she doesn't have that experience. And as Andy said, she hasn't really won that much since she was younger. So I don't know. I think plateauing is an interesting term because I don't think she peaked at 12. Nobody's saying that.
She didn't. Yeah. She won a major at 19.
Right.
And an LPGA tour event at 16.
And it's really hard to live up to those expectations.
Yeah.
Like, we see it with many players every year. So,
well, I've seen a lot of this from people far smarter than me about the golf swing. And you watch Lexi Thompson play and you watch some of it and you're like, that doesn't look great, you know? And I think there's certain merits to the discussion. She's obviously as physically gifted as anybody out there. And to a certain extent, this, you know, as you eloquently describe plateauing, when you plateau, there's a lot, like, she clearly works very hard. And maybe it's at this point time to examine some of the technique, because if you're working hard, you know, and this is like the hardest thing about golf is like, it's at the highest levels, the higher the level you go, the harder and harder it gets to get better. And the harder and harder you have to work for minimal gains in the game. And maybe she has reached the maximum capabilities that her technique allows.
Yeah. Well, I think there's an interesting discussion around what needs to improve here, right? There's, in fact, this debate is happening,
I mean,
right now.
She was afraid to chip the ball.
Yeah.
She wouldn't chip the ball after she chipped it three or four times.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it was Mike Clayton, I guess, who was just our guest on this podcast, recently on Twitter, past couple of days, posted a quote from Bernard Darwin about how we often mistake technical problems for mental and emotional problems. You know, obviously with the implication that perhaps Lexi's issues with technique that we see in her swing are in fact the issue and not necessarily what is going on upstairs. But I don't know if that completely comports with what I saw on Sunday at the U.S. Women's Open. I saw mental issues plaguing her tee to green, not just with the golf swing, but obviously with chipping and putting as well. And she's trying this new method of kind of trying to keep it light, but you can see the strain in that, I think.
Well, I think that's everybody plays their best golf when they're really themselves, right? And mm-hmm. this idea of trying to be somebody else on a golf course, I believe is a fleeting thing.
Like, absolutely.
Like the, what you need, you're going to perform the best in anything when you're just uniquely yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, watching her try to laugh off bad shots, it was just uncomfortable. It's like, that's not who you are. You need to, like, I mean, Brooks Koepka isn't out there laughing in major championships. He is like a bulldog, like focus over everything. And he's not trying to, if he hits a squirrely one, he's not like laughing it off with his caddy. He's just deadpan. I'm going to go have the most impressive up and down you've ever seen.
It reminds me of, like, you know, Tiger. So Tiger in his prime obviously was like the most cold-blooded player ever. And then we saw the new Tiger when he came back that was really, like, you know, laughing, lighthearted, you know, friendly with all these players. And I can't remember. I think it was Zach Johnson. I can't remember who it was. Said something about how on Sunday of the 2019 Masters, they were walking. And they were walking by Tiger and they said something to him and got nothing. And they saw, they were like, I hadn't seen that look in Tiger's eye. And it was like that killer was back.
Was it Finau?
I can't remember who it was.
Never mind.
But somebody it kills me. I can't remember. But somebody talked about how they saw the look in his eye and they were like, that's a different guy than that's the old guy. And I think that's the thing, is like he won that tournament playing that ice cold playing partner that he won 14 other majors being. And, you know, in the biggest, the most pressure moments, you have to be confident in yourself on the golf course.
I mean, even with Phil, like 2 weeks ago, he was, Phil is not Tiger. He's going to joke with the fans, even when he's trying to win a major at 50 years old. Like, I think those are two perfect examples of being yourself lets you be your best self.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The best champions in the world, the best champions in the history are never the ones that go through these identity crises. They never right. are the ones.
That they're, was the same Phil that we saw all along.
They're the
being
subjects.
Sneaky. Yeah. That's Phil.
They're the subjects of psychologists. Right. They are not the students, right? Or the patients. Like they're the ones that the psychologists come to study.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they go see psychologists outside of golf, but the golf persona is
the one the sports psychologists want to like get inside and understand.
Yeah.
So that they can teach their, like, I think that's the thing, is that there's some sort of level, and that's, I think that's the beauty of golf and what makes it so interesting beyond it, is there's such a human element in it compared to other sports. Is like, I think the only thing I've thought of that really compare are like pitching and baseball, particularly, I mean, look at closers in baseball. And the psychological thing.
Most
like,
of them are crazy.
So many of them just wilt. And you know, you never want your baseball team to have a bad closer. Like, it's the worst feeling in the world. But like, and then there's also
free throws.
And kickers. Kickers in the NFL.
Yeah.
Like, I've lived through having Cody Parkey. Like, you don't want to have a guy that, like, and when the sport's not just purely a reaction based thing, it adds that human element into it so much more. And that's, I think, what makes golf so intoxicating from both a playing aspect and a viewing aspect.
Lasting impression?
I just can't wait to watch more women's golf. Like, I think the Open Championship is going to be an awesome thing to watch in the next decade. U.S. Women's Open and then the British Open, obviously. Why is it the British Women's Open and not the Women's
they,
Open?
They got it's rid the of Women's year, Open.
They got rid. Okay, yeah. they yeah. got rid of it.
Yeah, it's now it's the AIG AIG Women's Open.
Yeah, okay, that's new yeah. this year. Though.
It has changed a few times. I feel like.
Yeah. I always wonder that, but right. yeah, the Women's Open, their slate, of course, is like that's. You know, to me, anytime they play great golf courses, it becomes the number one event to watch that week.
Right. Yeah. No, Woburn doesn't need to be on the Rota.
No offense to champions either, but champions too.
Yeah. Let's go to some of these rules. Yeah. And plus, you know, I hope also, in addition to going to some of these courses that in the past we've associated with the U.S. Open, that the U.S. Women's Open can open up the array of courses that they can go to. Prairie Dunes coming immediately to mind, but there are obviously these courses that have been eliminated from the men's game that this tournament, I think, could go to and still create a U.S. Open-like atmosphere. Will, any lasting and single lasting impression for you?
No, I mean, I think that's a really good thing to end on. Like, this tournament made us excited to watch it, and it made us wanting more. I mean, women's golf, it should be on the boom with everyone, and I think more and more golf fans are coming around to that idea, and hopefully that just continues moving forward.
Pod was edited by Meg Atkins and Garrett Morrison, and thanks for listening. If you really enjoyed the podcast, feel free to leave us a little review, rate us, review us on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. That does actually indeed help us out. And we got the U.S. Open right around the corner, so another major in men's golf coming, and a few more women's majors coming right down the road here. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.